Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Douglas W. Ptolemy. He's a professor in the Department of Entomology and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Delaware. And we're talking about his new book, The Nature of Oaks, The Rich Ecology of Our Most Essential Native Trees. Doug, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Well, thank you, Mark.
How did this book come about?
I give the credit to my wife. She said, you should write a book about oaks. It was October. I looked out the window. There was our oak that we had planted. And I said, okay.
There you go. You actually planted this oak from an acorn?
Yes. Planted most of the oaks on our property from acorns. And several of them now are at least 60 feet tall. And that's 20 years, but oaks grow faster than people think.
That's still impressive. First of all, I bet a lot of people don't even realize you can use acorns to plant oaks.
You know, people, we all want instant gratification these days.
So you're right,
They want to buy a 15-foot tree, and they should be prepared to pay for that because they're expensive. But there's downsides. I mean, in order to move a tree like that, you have to root prune it, and the tree will just sit there for up to a decade trying to rebuild its root system. If I plant an acorn that same day, within that decade, my acorn will be bigger and healthier than the tree you spent $3,000 on. So,
well, that was a classic Severe. You know what you can do with those ornamentals. I want to ask you, could you conceivably write a book about a sycamore or a birch like this?
Well, I could, but it wouldn't be as rich a book because oaks do more than other plants. I mean, it's the perfect choice. Ecologically speaking, they're contributing more to ecosystems in the temperate zone, so not just North America, but across Eurasia, than any other plant genus. So, I could write about sycamore. Lots of things going on with sycamores. It just would be a shorter book.
And that's the thing. That's the point of this book. It is incredible the way that you present the whole web of life that exists around oaks. And you do it in a calendar way, which is really sort of nice for those of us who live in temperate zones.
Right.
Yeah, you can sort of you follow this one tree and all the things that are going on around it. It must have been tough to document some of the invertebrate life.
Well, of course, I'm an entomologist, so
that makes it easier. That makes it like you know what you're looking for. However, I don't care who you are. There's a lot of invertebrates that are tough to find.
There are. So I've been taking pictures of every moth species that is now making a living in our yard, and I'm up to 1,140. And just about 30% of them are on our oaks. So it's a lot of species.
Wow.
But I've got pictures of them. They're real. They're here.
Now, I want to address some issues for people. And this is one of the things that sort of irks me. People are having trees cut down in their yards in sort of, say, my neighborhood, for sure, because they don't want to deal with the leaves. Or they're afraid that the root system is going to, like, crack up the sidewalk or their driveway. Yeah. Can you talk about that? Just from an oak perspective.
Yeah. Well, that just illustrates perfectly that we do not appreciate the production of ecosystem services. It should be, I don't want top-down regulation, but it should be against the law to chop down any tree without a very good reason. The fact that it makes leaves is not a good reason. And there are a lot of myths surrounding the use of oaks in landscapes. Like they're going to get too big, they're going to fall on our house, they're going to lift up our sidewalks and our driveways. They're going to grow too slowly. So I just spend February in the book talking about those myths because there can be truth to them. Do oaks grow too slowly? Well, again, if you plant a big tree and it's just going to sit there for 10 years trying to build its root system, it looks like it's growing very slowly. If you plant an oak over bedrock, the roots will go laterally and they will lift up hardscape. But if you plant it in the right place with good soil underneath, the roots go deep. No problem with lifting. Let's see. What are the other myths?
I don't think people understand the how important leaf litter is to a whole range of creatures, not just invertebrates, but vertebrates too.
You know, the importance of the soil ecosystem is getting a lot of press, but what they don't talk about is what maintains the quality of that soil ecosystem. It's the leaf litter on top that keeps the soil, the moisture in the soil. Everything that's living in the soil, from the mycorrhizae to the columbillins to all of the nematodes and mites and all the detritivores that are breaking down the nutrients and returning them to the soil, they all need high humidity. They need moist soil. And when you rake the leaves away, the soil dries out, and all those things either go deep or disappear. Plus, then you have soil erosion. And we get rid of our leaves just because it's an aesthetic value. Leaf litter sends the message that you're not taking care of your yard.
Right.
But every time you scrape away leaves, you're taking away the nutrients that your tree needs the following year. You're wrecking that soil ecosystem. There are a number of things living in those leaves. So I talk about the importance of caterpillars in terms of feeding birds and other things.
Yeah.
Most of those caterpillars are pupating in the leaves or just beneath them. They fall from the tree, and then they complete their life cycle under the tree. And when you scrape all that away, you've thrown away all of those species. So it's one of the most destructive things you can do to your local landscape. Now, I know people say, well, I can't leave them on my lawn. And that's true. But I also say we need to reduce the area we have in lawn. And you can do that.
That's right. A lawn is probably the most sterile environment there is.
Yeah, other than pavement.
Right.
That's right. Well, you know, there are four things every landscape has to do. It's got to support pollinators. It's got to support a food web. It's got to sequester carbon. And it's got to support your local watershed. Lawn doesn't do any of those things. It actively destroys the watershed, doesn't support any pollinators or food web, and it's the worst plant choice for sequestering carbon that there is. Oaks, on the other hand, do three of those four things better than any other plant. The only thing they don't do better than other plants is support pollinators because they're wind pollinated.
Right. You're like a huge booster for oaks. After I get to the end of this book, I just imagine you walking around handing out pamphlets about oaks, wearing a huge button with an oak tree on it.
I did a webinar in California the other day, and to a woman named Kathy Kramer, and she said, we should take off on Franklin Delano Roosevelt's, we want a chicken in every pot. She said, we want an oak in every lot.
I like that.
That's great. I want to use that.
I like that. Well, you know, there's so much information in this book. Let's just skip around to some of the things that I just found interesting. You were talking before about the root system, and you had a story in the book about a group that tried to excavate the root system of a single oak and how extensive the root system was.
Right. You know, that's another myth that roots go as far as the drip line of the tree and then they stop. Well, this group wanted to see how far the root system of a Quercus robur, the English oak, the King's oak in England, went. And they started digging it up and they got three times the width of the canopy, which was over 300 feet from the trunk. And then they gave up. And that, you know, that's a problem because it's hard to go that far in a suburban setting without hitting a road or a cellarway or something, a pipeline that interrupts the root systems. Oaks have a long life cycle, 900 years on average.
Wow.
But most oaks don't live that long because we don't allow them to grow to their, you know, particularly their root system.
Let's just talk about acorns for a minute, because one of the things I became really fascinated, there's an entire ecology of acorns, just the acorns themselves. First of all, acorns come in several, they're sort of all variations on a theme, but they come in different sizes.
Many, yeah. You know, there are 91 species of oaks in North America.
And all of their acorns look different.
All of their acorns look different, yeah. And some, the biggest one is the bur oak. And it's a good sizable acorn. The smallest one, a couple that are very, very, very small, about, less than a third the size of that bur oak acorn.
Now, you write that You write that
A lot of variation in acorns, a lot of variation in oaks in general, and leaf size, leaf shape. A lot of people think all oaks have lobed leaves. They don't.
Right.
Many of them, some of them look like hollies, some of them look like willow leaves, some of them have no lobing at all. They, like the live oaks, you wouldn't ever know it's an oak leaf if you're looking for lobing. And that's true with acorns as well.
You write that a single tree will drop 3 million acorns. Is that in a season?
No, in its lifetime.
Okay. That's still an enormous amount of acorns. Now, acorns are an important food for an amazing number of creatures. But let's talk about masting. What is masting?
Masting is it's the irregular production of acorns. So some years they will produce a whole bunch. That's called a mast year. And then typically the following year, and sometimes several following years, they produce almost none. And that's very unusual for a plant. Plants usually produce about the same number of seeds every year. So everybody wants to explain it. Why mast? And there are a number of hypotheses, but one of them is that there are a lot of things eat acorns. They depend on them. There are a number of rodents and you know, deer and turkeys and birds and
right.
acorn weevils and acorn moths. And if they made the same number of acorns every year, the populations of these acorn eaters would stabilize around that number, and they'd eat just about every single acorn, which means the oak, it would be hard for them to actually reproduce. But if they vary the number, so if you make a whole bunch one year, then the population of acorn weevils explodes, then the next year you make almost none, then the population crashes. The number of squirrels is decreased, and if you have a couple of years with very few acorns, the things that eat acorns become scarce. And then you make a whole bunch again, and you have swamped the acorn predator population. So predator reduction is one of the main explanations for masting.
One of the fascinating things to watch around here is to watch blue jays storing acorns for the winter. Do they
right.
remember every location they're putting an acorn in? Because they're putting them in lawns, they're putting them in the corners of houses, they're putting them in trees, they're putting them in everywhere. Do blue jays actually have a memory for these locations?
Well, they have a good memory, but it is far from perfect. And that actually benefits oaks. So in a mast year, a single blue jay can bury 4,500 acorns. But they only remember where one in four is, which means a single blue jay has planted 3,300 oak trees, and they will fly
wow.
a mile from the parent tree to bury that acorn. So that allows oaks to move farther and faster, to disperse as a population farther and faster than any other tree genus in the world.
Now, it's not around here in New England, but I've seen them out. I've seen them out west. Acorn woodpeckers
right.
do one of the best behaviors with acorns I've ever seen.
Yeah. Well, they're doing the same thing as blue jays in that they're storing acorns for the winter, but they don't do it underground. They get a snag, a dead tree, and then they drill holes in the tree, and they stick the acorn in the holes. And those trees last a long time. So you get a family unit of acorn woodpeckers protecting that tree. And over time, they keep adding more and more holes. You can get 50,000 holes in a single tree.
What?
And then they fill every one with an acorn.
It's an amazing thing to look at. I love seeing them. Now,
yeah,
go ahead. I have a go ahead.
I'm sorry, I was just gonna say, if you have an acorn woodpecker tree in your yard, it's enormously entertaining.
It is. It really is. I sat there for just like an hour watching them come back and forth and storing the acorns. Now,
yeah, that's great.
There are things known as acorn weevils, and I have a funny story to tell you. Way back in the late 60s, early 70s, there was a book called Stalking the Wild Asparagus. It was about you know, gathering wild food. And it talked about making acorns glacé so you could sort of sugarcoat these acorns. So a bunch of us went out and we gathered several shopping bags full of acorns and we left them in the kitchen overnight. And I remember coming up in the middle of the night and it looked like the floor was sort of seething. And they were the larva of the acorn weevils.
Yeah, they tunnel that. If you put them in a plastic bag, they chew right through the plastic bag.
Yep, yep. Oh, my God. I never knew that they were that common. And I've never seen an adult. I've only seen the larva.
It's true. The larvae are easier to come by. The adults are, I'm going to call them nocturnal. You know, you'll find them during the day, but they're much more common at night. And the ones I've seen come to light. So I usually put up a light to collect moths, and that's when I see the acorn weevils.
It has got an enormous front part, which is not a proboscis.
It's not a nose. That's right. That's an extension of the head capsule, and the mouth parts are at the end of that extension.
It's got one of the most impressive ones of any weevil.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. But that's what they use to chew a hole into the acorn, and then they lay an egg in the hole, and that's how the larva gets down into the acorn.
Now, there are even tiny species of ants that go in a tiny hole in an acorn.
Yeah, the genus Temnothorax. There's three species that live in tiny holes, and they love the holes that are left behind when an acorn weevil leaves an acorn. So they move the entire colony into that hole.
Wow.
And it takes about 2 years for that acorn to break down and you know, disintegrate. So they live there very happily for 2 years. And then they've got to find another acorn.
Now, talk to me about galls.
Yes. Galls are made by little wasps in the family Cynipidae.
Well,
let's
describe what we're talking about. Let's talk about the classic oak gall, which is not that complex. It's sort of a brown, small ball.
it's hard to talk about the classic gall because there's 5,000 species of cynipids.
And every one of them has a different gall.
Everyone has a different gall.
Around here, though, there's one that seems to be most prominent, or at least it's the easiest one to see.
Oak bullet gall.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's probably the oak bullet gall, and it stays there. You know, once the galler leaves, it stays there for years, so you see a lot of them.
People call
a gall a cancerous growth, but I don't like that analogy because cancerous growth are uncontrolled growth of cells. Galls are highly controlled cells. The egg is laid into an oak bud, and that's meristematic tissue. It's stem cells, essentially, that can go in any direction. So the female wasp injects not just the egg, but also plant hormones to direct the growth of that gall. And of course, the oak has plant hormones too, and it directs the growth of that gall. And the resulting gall is actually a compromise between the cynipid and the galler itself.
Now, if you were to cut a gall in half, what would you find?
A lot of those galls are essentially hollow. The galler itself is right in the center, in a little disc in the center, but the rest of the space is hollow. And it's hollow because the outside of the gall should be a greater distance from the galler itself than the length of the ovipositor of the natural enemies, the parasitoids that want to lay an egg in the galler. So that space between the galler and the outside of the gall is often, you know, sometimes it's almost an inch because the mechanism by which these parasitoids, these other wasp species, lay their eggs in the galler, it's a like a sword. It's a needle shape ovipositor, and some of them are quite long. So the gall has to have a space bigger than that.
Well,
otherwise they can reach it.
You have to explain what the parasitoids are doing. They're laying an egg in the young of the gall wasps.
That's right. There are more species of parasitoids on gallers than any other type of insect. They've got an enormous complex of natural enemies. So they're parasites, except a true parasite does not kill its host. Parasitoids do kill the host. And that's why we have a different word for it.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Douglas W. Ptolemy. He's a professor in the Department of Entomology and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Delaware, and we're talking about his new book, which I cannot recommend enough. It's a wonderful book, The Nature of Oaks. It's a perfect summer book. The Rich Ecology of Our Most Essential Native Trees. Now, there's a behavior of some oaks, and people see that this up here. It's called leaf marcescence.
That's right. They hold on to their leaves. Oaks are deciduous. Well, many species of oaks are deciduous. Some actually are. The live oaks hold on to the leaves all the time, but most deciduous trees drop their leaves in the fall. But members of the white oak group in particular do not. The leaves are dead, but they hang on to them, and they'll hang on to them all winter long. So that's another curious behavior. Why are they doing that?
Yeah.
The leading hypothesis is that not that long ago, 8,000-9,000 years ago, the land was full of big mammals, mammoths and giant sloths that could reach up 18 feet. And many of those were browsers, meaning they're not eating grass on the ground. They were eating buds, woody stem material, particularly the buds. So oaks, the theory is that oaks surround their buds with their dead leaves from the previous year, and it makes it an untasty mouthful. And in that way, they protect their buds from all that mammal grazing. And if you look at the distribution of these marcescent leaves, they only go up about 18 feet. And above that, there are no marcissus leaves. And that's about as high as the giant sloth could reach.
Well, you know, you also wrote about, and there's so many interesting facts that I learned in this book. The largest oak leaves are on the bottom, and the smallest are at the top. Why is that?
Right, yeah. Because the bottom is shaded. Leaves are there to gather energy from the sun. And if you make a leaf, you want it to do its job. But if it's at the bottom of the tree, the top leaves are shading it. So it's got to be bigger to get enough of the sun's energy so that it actually can photosynthesize. At the top of the tree, it gets full sun all the time, so it doesn't have to be that big in order to do it.
Now, you write that in the January section of the book. You spotted a golden crown kinglet in your oak. What was it doing?
Well, I wasn't sure what it was doing, but when I looked into it, the golden crown kinglets are tiny birds. They're smaller than chickadees. They are insectivores. They eat insects and spiders all the time, including in the winter. And that's, I called it the kinglet paradox. They should have migrated. They should have gone south like other small birds where there are lots of insects. But they don't. They hang around the north all winter long. Well, Bernd Heinrich, he's a wonderful naturalist. You write the column in Natural History every month. He doesn't like paradoxes. So he actually looked in the crops of golden crown kinglets in Maine in January, and he found they were full of caterpillars.
Wow.
So that's what they're doing. They're up there in the trees getting caterpillars. There's no more kinglet paradox. But now the question is, what are the caterpillars doing up in the tree when there's no leaves to eat? And there are a lot of them. You can find them, take pictures of them. They look like little sticks. The only thing we can think of is that they are there ready to go when the new leaves burst forth in the spring. So if you overwinter as an egg, you're going to hatch that as a very tiny little caterpillar. These guys are big. They're almost full-grown larvae, and they can outcompete anything. They essentially have an unlimited supply of leaf material in the spring if the kinglet doesn't eat them first.
We're almost out of time, but one of the things I want you to talk about is how important oaks are for migrating songbirds. And I'm an avid birder, and I know that if I want to look for migrants, I go to an oak.
That's right, particularly warblers.
That's right.
And you go there because that's where the caterpillars are. You know, when migrants come up in the spring, there are no berries, there are no seeds. The plants haven't made them yet. So they're looking for insects, particularly caterpillars. So the trees that make the most caterpillars are the most most valuable to not just migrants, but the residents as well. Because our baby birds can't eat seeds. They're reared on caterpillars. Well, oaks support more than 950 species of caterpillars in this country.
Jeez.
And other trees, like a tulip tree, they support 21. So there's huge differences between oaks and most of our other native plants. And that's why I said we've got the highest biodiversity value. They're passing on more energy through those caterpillars than any other type of plant.
In May here in Massachusetts, especially in central Massachusetts, just as the sun is starting to come up, you always want to look to the top of an oak, because that's where things like the black-throated greens, black-throated blues, blackburnians, and all those other migrant warblers, that's where they're going to gather looking for insect food first, is at the tops of oaks.
That's right. That's right.
You have an impressive yard list of birds that came to your oak.
We've got 60 species of birds that have bred in our yard now since we put the plants back.
Wow.
And our property was mowed for hay when we moved in. So it's a great example that we really can restore the life around us if we simply put the plants that support that life back.
That's right. That's right. Finally, oaks are a great place to look for Polyphemus cocoons.
That's right.
And if people have never seen a Polyphemus moth, it's impressive.
One of our giant silk moths, one of the largest, and it loves oak trees. And the moth completes its life on the oak. The caterpillars eat the leaves. Then they spin a cocoon which hangs from the branches. And right about now is a good time to look for those cocoons, because the marcescent leaves have dropped and those cocoons are hanging there. They're not common. You know, of the problem is we have our lights on all the time, and
that
kills these nocturnal moths. But any that are left, it's a good time of year to look for them. Look for the cocoons anyway. They'll be emerging soon.
Well,
it doesn't stop snowing.
What's don't even go there. Is there where on the tree would you look for it? Is it just on the main trunk, or is it on one of the branches?
Oh, no. Yeah, it's hanging from a – it'd be on a terminal branch. But we typically look low because we're standing on the ground.
That's right.
It's a good question. What's happening in the top of the tree? For the most part, we don't know because nobody's up there looking.
Wait,
my impression is more of this stuff happens low, but that's just because I look low more. So.
Yeah. Because you write that you have a section on tree crickets, I think. And you talk about most of their life is spent in the upper parts of the tree.
Well, on the tree, as opposed to on the ground, like bush crickets. So they're called tree and bush crickets. And they're very interesting because they have found a way to, you know, when males sing, they want to attract the female. And the female wants to go to the male that is the loudest.
Oh, this is a fascinating photograph that's in your book. I never knew they did this.
Yeah. That's a message that of male quality. You can't be loud unless you're a strong male.
So they find a hole. Well, they find a hole in a leaf.
They find a hole in a leaf, and they sing with their wings. So they raise their wings and move them back and forth, and that's what makes the chirping sound. But when you do that with your head stuffed through this hole and the wings filling the hole, most leaves are parabolic in shape, and it projects the sound out farther and louder than if you sang on a flat surface.
Oh, man.
So you're actually sending a false message to the female. You're saying, I'm a big male, when in fact you're not so big. But it's a smart male, so that might be good enough.
And I think that counts for more. We're completely out of time. My guest tonight has been Douglas W. Ptolemy. He is a professor in the Department of Entomology and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Delaware. And we've been talking about his new book. It is so entertaining, so fascinating, so interesting. It takes you through the year of a single oak, the nature of oaks, the rich ecology of our most essential native trees. Read it and you will plant an oak. Douglas, it's been a pleasure.
I've enjoyed it. Thanks, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.